Hey, good morning, everybody. 231 Students Anatomy, November 25th, and this is Wednesday. We're going to finish up respiratory chapter, move into digestive system today, and don't forget, tomorrow is Thanksgiving, and we haven't talked about the digestive system yet. Oh, I don't know. Maybe we'll have time to get to at least the stomach, and you can we'll be able to relate that to tomorrow. All right, so let's take a look at the schedule. Where are we on this particular schedule? Great. 25th, November. Well, we're way down here on the bottom. Here we are, respiratory. So we're doing good. We're a little bit ahead of schedule, not too bad. All right, we're scheduled next week to have a digestive system lecture and urinary system. Probably we'll make some good progress on both of those. Maybe even start with diversification system. All right, and then also, 2 weeks from today is your final exam. It's not a final, it's not cumulative, but it is your last exam. These are the chapters that it covers. All those study guides for those chapters are in Blackboard, and I'm sure you found them already and are working on them. Okay, the exam figures and end of chapter questions and all that kind of stuff. All right, also that last week, starting on December 7th, we're going to have the fourth practicum set up in lab for you. And, of course, the Monday group, Monday labs have to take it on Monday. The Wednesday labs are scheduled to take it on Wednesday, but they can take it on Monday if they want to get it out of the way. All right, so let me know. Maybe you have to let me know ahead of time. Make sure I have room in lab for you. All right, everybody, hold on. Just let's listen to lecture. If you got to talk to somebody, go ahead, step outside so you don't interrupt somebody else that's just paying attention, okay? Okay. So, anybody have a question? Schedule or respiratory system? Did some demos last time for you. And one of the cool, I think one of the fun demos was, all right, look at all these elastic fibers around each alveolus. So when an alveolus expands, you need a diaphragm to expand these alveoli, but to get air out of them, all you have to do is relax. Expiration is passive, does not require any muscle contraction for that to happen. All right, so let's go down to mechanics of breathing. Okay, mechanics of breathing. Well, air is a fluid, and it's going to flow from one place to another. And that's going to be determined by some physical property. What physical property of matter will allow a liquid to move from one place to another? Concentration. For particles, I would say, yeah, that's really good. And it's very similar to concentration. Very similar to concentration when we use that to understand how diffusion works. Okay, but in this particular case, there's a better way of thinking about concentration, and it is by pressure. It's the pressure. So a fluid will flow from, just like the fusion, from high pressure to low pressure. And as a matter of fact, if we want to consider all of the components that are in a gas, we consider the partial pressure, which is like concentration almost. All right, so the reason why air flows in and out of our lungs is because we change the volume of our thoracic cavity. And there is a physical principle I'll write on the board called Boyle's Law. You don't have to know Boyle's Law, but you should be a little bit familiar with it. It just says that pressure is going to be equal to 1 over the volume. 1 over the volume. Nice, simple equation. Can anybody, I don't know if anybody has experience working with equations at all. This is really nice and simple, but this is a certain kind of relationship. And I want to know what kind of relationship that is. Can anybody describe what kind of relationship that is? It is an inverse relationship. It's not directly related. They are inversely related, which means if volume goes up, what happens to pressure? Inversely related goes the other way, right? All right, so if volume goes up, pressure goes down. If volume goes down, pressure goes up, right? So if we divide one by a smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller number, then this whole number gets bigger. Right, so just remember that nice inverse relationship. And the way that we change pressures in our thorax is by adjusting the volume. And the way we adjust the volume is that we activate skeletal muscles. that are attached to our skeleton. Okay, and also another muscle that's not really attached to the skeleton, that's the diaphragm. Diaphragm is the most important muscle for inspiration. All right, and so let's continue on with that. There are two kinds of breathing. And there's first quiet breathing, which is what you're doing right now, and then there is forced breathing. For instance, when you are exercising, when you need to get a lot more air in and out of your chest to extract that oxygen. So for quiet breathing, contraction of the diaphragm is really all that is necessary. So where is that diaphragm at? Diaphragm. Let's pull it up. Okay, so here is the diaphragm. You know it as a separation between the thoracic and abdominal cavities. But when the diaphragm is relaxed, it has this big curve in it. We call it a dome shape. All right, so when the diaphragm is relaxed, it's pushing up into the thoracic cavity. When the diaphragm contracts, right, the diaphragm gets shorter, and the shortest distance between two points is a straight line. All right, it's not a curved line. So the straight line goes like this. So when the diaphragm contracts, the thoracic cavity increases by the volume that I'm circling right here. All right, so if the volume of the thorax increases, what happens to the pressure inside the thorax? Don't forget, inverse relationship. If volume increases, what happens to pressure? It decreases. So now we have low pressure in the lungs, still high pressure in the air, so air will flow from high to low, from atmosphere into the lungs, when the thoracic cavity is enlarged. All right, that's for quiet breathing. Now, as far as expiration is concerned, the only thing that has to happen is relaxation of the diaphragm, because there's elastic properties of the diaphragm, then it goes from a straight line back up to this dome-shaped structure, and it decreases the volume of the thorax. So what happens to the pressure inside the thorax when the volume decreases? What happens to pressure when volume decreases? Inverse relationship. So if volume decreases, pressure increases. It goes the opposite way. And when there's high pressure in the lungs and relatively low in the air, then air is going to be expelled from the lungs into the air over here. All right, so that's how we adjust breathing. So here are some, let me go back one. Right here, inspiration. Okay, so here is the diaphragm. Okay, we see that for inspiration, when it contracts, it moves inferiorly, increasing the size of the thorax. But there are also there are intercostal muscles that will elevate the rib cage, both anteriorly, like we see over here, and laterally. Right, it will pull the ribs up and out. And when that happens, that also increases the volume of the thorax. So the diaphragm contraction of the external intercostals, increases the volume of the thorax, decreasing the pressure inside the lungs, causing air to flow in the lungs. All right, so these intercostal muscles used for inspiration are what we call the external. These are the most superficial muscles. Okay, expiration. For quiet breathing is passive. All you have to do is relax. But when you are breathing in a forced mode, like for instance when you're exercising, we do need some additional muscles. All right, so we relax the diaphragm. That works for sure. Then the internal intercostals will pull the rib cage back down, both anteriorly and laterally. Right, so the rib cage will shrink down in those directions, and the volume decreases, increasing the pressure and air flows out of our lungs. So here is a list of all the nice muscles involved for quiet breathing, contraction of the diaphragm. That's all. For quiet breathing, what about expiration? For quiet breathing, just relaxation. It's completely passive, does not require any muscles. So expiration is completely passive for quiet breathing. All right, but when we're breathing rapidly, right, for inspiration, we can use contraction of the pectoralis minor, the external intercostal, sternocleidomastoid, even serratus anterior. These all will elevate the ribs and the sternum, increasing the size of the thoracic cavity. For forced breathing, okay, then we want to employ some other muscles. Right? Well, you know what, for quiet breathing, it doesn't require any. So for forced breathing, we need to recruit some muscles, including the internal intercostals, the rectus abdominis, and as a matter of fact, all of the abdominal muscles will help with expiration. Now, why the heck is that going to help us? Okay, let's go back to maybe this slide right here. Okay, so all of the abdominal muscles are below the diaphragm, and deep to all of those abdominal muscles are visceral organs like stomach, pancreas, small intestine. When all of those are compressed by the stomach muscles, all of them, right, they push up into the diaphragm, and that pushes up into the thoracic cavity, decreasing the volume even further. Right, so when the abdominal muscles contract, it decreases the volume of the thoracic cavity, increasing the pressure so that expiration can take place. All right, but the strange thing probably you should be aware of is that for quiet breathing, for expiration, right, it's just relaxation of the diaphragm and no muscle contraction because of the elastic properties everywhere else. Okay, I think I want to go over the membranes around the lungs one more time. We talked about the respiratory membrane already, but another membrane, the serous membrane. Remember, there are two major kinds of membranes in the body, mucus and, what's another kind, mucus. Okay, mucus lines a cavity that's open to the outside world. There's another membrane that lines a cavity not open to the outside world. That is a serous membrane. Mucus membrane has only one component, but a serous membrane has three. Right? It has three. There's a component that's right on the surface of the visceral organ. So here I see a nice lung, that's the visceral organ, and there's a membrane right on the top of it. It's part of the serous membrane. And since it's around the lungs, it's the pleural membrane. But what division of the pleural membrane is it? It is the visceral division because it's touching the visceral organ. Right, so here is the visceral division of the pleural membrane. It folds back on itself like this, right? So now it's not touching the lung, it's actually touching the wall of the thorax. So this is what we call the parietal division of the pleural membrane. And then there's a space between them, and that's the pleural space. And that's filled with fluid. And that fluid is kind of sticky so that the surface of the lung is attached to the wall of the thorax. So when the thorax moves, the lungs kind of go with it as well, right? Decreasing the pressure. All right, you have the same kind of serous membranes around the heart. If you look at this, right here you can see the visceral pericardium, right? Here's the parietal pericardium, and then there's even a fibrous pericardium on top of that, right? And with the pericardial space in between the visceral and parietal divisions, because the heart is in a cavity not open to the outside world, just like the lungs. All right, so this slide right here is pretty instructive, so I'm going to zoom way in. Can you still see the lungs, that this is really lungs right here? Oh yeah, look at that, that's nice. Okay, so let's think about this. How many chambers does the heart have? Four, yeah, you got to know four, because test is coming up. How many valves does the heart have? Four, right. How many sides does the heart have? It's got two. So how many circulations are there in the body? That's two, because basically you have a left heart and a right heart. Basically you have two hearts. One pumps through the systemic circulation and the other pumps through the pulmonary circulation, and that's what we're looking at right here, right? We're looking at pulmonary circulation, and I see some red vessels and some blue vessels, and so I want to know, if I point to this vessel right here, this red one, go ahead and name that red blood vessel. It's a pulmonary. I like it. Pulmonary what? It's going to either be a vein or an artery, and it should be popping right in your mind that it is the, okay, systemic circulation, it will be an artery. But in the pulmonary circulation, all these vessels that are high in oxygen are coming back from the lungs to the heart. And so what kind of vessel brings blood back to the heart? A vein. So all of these red vessels right here are pulmonary veins. Systemic veins are going to be color-coded blue because they're low in oxygen. So if you think of the systemic circulation and the pulmonary circulation, they're opposite each other. Don't forget that. Pulmonary is opposite. So blue vessels are arteries in the pulmonary circulation. Red ones are veins. And that makes sense because when blood is going to the lungs, why are the lungs there? To oxygenate the blood, right? And so there would be no need for oxygenated blood to go to the lungs because it's already in the blood, right? So relatively low oxygen, it becomes oxygenated, turns red, and it goes back to the heart via the pulmonary vein. All right, so that's kind of a tricky question, but make sure you can see that. Probably there's one or two questions somewhere like that. All right, so let me see what else. Oh, mechanics of breathing. Oh, here are these the pleural membranes that we talked about just now, so you should be aware of that. I have another demonstration that we can look at pretty carefully and quickly. So here is a model of the lungs right here. The glass is representing the wall of the thorax. Okay, and then this little tube, this little opening right here would be like the trachea, right, bringing air into the lungs, and the lungs are these balloons inside that glass bell. And this black rubber thing is representing the diaphragm, and it can move, right? We can push it up into the thoracic cavity, or we can pull it down. If we push it up, we decrease the volume of this chamber. When we decrease the volume, what happens to pressure? Decreased volume, pressure goes up, okay? And if that is the case, then the air in this balloon, right, gets pressurized, and so the air in the balloon should be expelled through this trachea into the room. And if we increase the volume by pulling down on the diaphragm, right, pulling down increases the volume, right, increasing volume, what happens to pressure? Okay, if we increase volume, pressure decreases. So now we have decreased pressure in the balloons, so high pressure in the air, so air from the room will enter the balloons. Right? And so it's just pretty much simple like that. So what should we do first? Well, let's just relax. All right. So when we're relaxed, the lungs don't have any air in them. Right? And I don't know if you can see that the balloons are kind of collapsed right here. And if the diaphragm contracts, it's going to move inferiorly, increasing the volume of the lungs. So I'm going to pull on it like that. What happened to the balloons? They inflated, and when the diaphragm relaxed, decreases the volume, then the balloons deflate. Right? Increasing volume, decreasing volume. And so skeletal muscles do that. Except for quiet breathing, there's enough elasticity in the lungs and the diaphragm that is completely passive. That's what happens. But when you're exercising, moving rapidly, then you need all of the muscles, right, for inspiration and expiration. Okay, I can have this in lab if you want to look at it. But that is just some of the physics behind inspiration and expiration. Okay, control of respiration is sort of interesting because the control of respiration is controlled by chemicals inside your body. Can you think of any chemicals that your body might want to monitor to adjust respiration? Kind of chemical. Why are you inhaling? Why are you inhaling? To get oxygen inside your body, right? For mitochondria so that they can make ATP. And so the reason why we inhale is to increase oxygen. So there are chemoreceptors that can monitor oxygen concentration in our body. All right? And there's another chemical that's important. Your body needs oxygen to make ATP, and in the process, it produces carbon dioxide. And what's the reason why we exhale? To get rid of carbon dioxide. So there are other chemoreceptors in your body that monitor carbon dioxide. Those are primarily the two most important, oxygen and carbon dioxide. And if you were going to build a body, which one do you think would be better for you to monitor to adjust your rate of respiration, carbon dioxide or oxygen? I always thought it was oxygen because it's so important for making ATP. But you know what? It is carbon dioxide. So let's take a look and see how that happens. The respiratory center we see here in the medulla and the pons, and there are a number of nuclei in these areas. Actually, there's three. And what is a nucleus again? It's a group of nerve cell bodies and dendrites, right? It's a little center where neurons can exchange information. It's a little control center, control node. And there are these three little nodes. The ventral respiratory group right here is the pacemaker for ventilation. Just like there's a pacemaker on your heart, this one right here will send signals via the phrenic nerve to the diaphragm to cause it to contract. Right, so the diaphragm, we'll tell you, tell me, is it a skeletal muscle or a smooth muscle or cardiac muscle? Is it under voluntary control or involuntary? Involuntary. Kind of makes sense that it's involuntary, right? Because when you're sleeping at night, you don't have to think about contracting it. But you know what? We could all hold our breath right now, right? So we have voluntary control over the diaphragm, so it is a skeletal muscle. As a matter of fact, we all could hold our breath until we pass out. And I don't know if you ever did that as a kid to scare your parents. Anybody do that? No? Oh, I see some people smile. You did that? How many times? A lot of times? Not too often. Okay, and that's really not too dangerous because as soon as somebody passes out, then these centers right here take over and you start to breathe once again. All right, so the diaphragm is under voluntary control, but it can be assisted by automatic control from the pons and the medulla, which is what we call the respiratory center. And the pacemaker in the respiratory center is this ventral respiratory group. And this dorsal group right here also gets information from other parts of the body, and it can influence, it can speed up this ventral respiratory group. All right, so if this one speeds it up, what can you tell me about antagonism? Is antagonism a good thing to employ in your body? Like biceps brachii, triceps brachii? Like sympathetic nervous system, parasympathetic nervous system? Antagonism is very good in terms of control. And here is the part of the respiratory center in the pons, so we call it the pontine respiratory center. This one will inhibit the dorsal and the ventral respiratory group. So the dorsal is excitatory, the pontine is inhibitory, and it's the balance of these two nuclei that determine the frequency at which nerve impulses travel down to the diaphragm to cause the diaphragm to contract. All right, so antagonism is extremely important. And you might have to know sometime what's the name of the nerve that goes to the diaphragm. Because without this nerve, guess what? You cannot breathe. Unconsciously or consciously, it does not matter because your body needs this phrenic nerve to get there. Oh, I asked you what the name was. Sorry about that. It is what? Phrenic nerve. But you already know what the origin of the phrenic nerve is. You can kind of see it coming from the brain, so it's a cranial nerve. Oh no, not a cranial nerve. It goes out through the foramen magnum, and it is actually a spinal nerve. And the origin of the phrenic is C3, 4, and 5. So if you destroy your spinal cord below C3, 4, and 5, you will still be able to breathe. But if there's an injury to the spinal cord above C3, anywhere above C3, then the phrenic nerve won't get any information and this diaphragm will stop contracting, and then you suffocate when that happens. Okay? So just remember, the origin of the phrenic nerve is C3, 4, and 5. And I think I told you about a little saying that might help you remember that. And it goes C3, 4, and 5 does what? C3, 4, and 5 keeps you alive. That will help you remember those, the roots of that phrenic nerve. All right, so it goes to the diaphragm. Diaphragm is voluntary muscle, but it can be controlled by the respiratory center, right, automatically, but nonetheless, you still have control. All right, so the inputs to the respiratory center. Well, we have chemoreceptors. Chemoreceptors are certain kinds of receptors that can monitor the concentration of chemicals inside the body. There are central receptors and peripheral receptors. Central just means central nervous system. For instance, like in the medulla and the pons, they have receptors. Okay, and they can monitor carbon dioxide. And it just so happens that carbon dioxide is linked to the pH of a fluid. And does anybody know what pH is? It's the measure of acidity of a liquid, right? So if the pH goes down, it becomes more acidic. So I see a down arrow right here, which means decreasing pH, which means that the brain is becoming more acidic. Right, so if carbon dioxide goes up, I just see one little arrow right here, pH goes down a little bit. What's the effect on ventilation? As CO2 builds up in your body becomes more acidic. What happens to ventilation? It increases. There's that little up arrow. Right? And as a matter of fact, this is the most sensitive system for controlling ventilation. It is based on carbon dioxide and pH. And you see oxygen here? There's no oxygen. So oxygen concentration in your body is not a sensitive indicator for adjusting ventilation. It is carbon dioxide and pH. All right, so not only do you have central receptors, but you have peripheral receptors in the carotid sinus and the arch of the aorta. Who knows where this carotid sinus is? Anybody remember where carotid sinus is? Okay, I tell you what is the third branch off of the arch of the aorta, the third branch? Should we start with the first one? What's the first branch? Brachiocephalic, trunk or artery. What's the second one? The common carotid. Yeah, that's where we want to be. So we're in the common carotid, and we go up to the brain because that's the job of the common carotid, bring blood to the head. And when it gets into your neck, it bifurcates, right, to the internal carotid and the external. Internal takes blood to the brain. That's really important. Right, and right at that junction right there is the carotid sinus. It's like a little bulge, and it has pressure sensors there, and it has chemo sensors there to help adjust heart rhythms and respiratory rhythms. Right, so that's why we call it the carotid sinus. And the carotid sinus chemoreceptors are not very sensitive to CO2 and pH. They are sensitive to oxygen. But look, how many arrows do I have right here? One or many? Many, that's right. So these peripheral chemoreceptors respond only when there's a drastic reduction in oxygen, not just a little bit, not like the central chemoreceptors for carbon dioxide. They're very sensitive. Small changes in carbon dioxide have an effect on ventilation. But oxygen, due to these peripheral receptors, there has to be a huge change. And if oxygen goes down, what's the drive for ventilation? Increase or decrease? Increase. And that makes perfect sense, right? But there has to be a really drastic decrease in oxygen before, right, that response takes place. All right, I'm going to talk about that in just a little bit. So what else? Oh, okay. That's sort of interesting from the following perspective. There are people that like to go fishing out in the ocean, not with a fishing rod, but they like to go down with a spear gun, and they're called free divers. They don't carry any oxygen tanks or anything, right? And they go down really, really deep. They can be fishing like 40 feet, 50 feet underwater. And they do a little trick so that they don't have an urgency to breathe when they're underwater, right? And the little trick is this, right? So we see that carbon dioxide is a very powerful stimulator for ventilation. But if you hyperventilate, if you breathe very rapidly for a period of time, like 30 seconds or a minute, your body loses a lot of carbon dioxide. All right? And when your body loses carbon dioxide, what happens to the drive for ventilation? It decreases. You don't have the sense that you have to breathe if you hyperventilate. All right? But your muscles are still working. They're still demand for oxygen. Oxygen is being used up to make that ATP. And what happens to these divers sometimes when they hyperventilate, they get rid of that sensation that they have to breathe, dive underwater, use up all their oxygen, and they don't feel that happening. And when they use up enough oxygen, guess what happens to them? Without warning, they pass out, right? Because your brain needs oxygen to make ATP. All right, and now they're 30 feet underwater and you're passed out. What's the consequence of that? Then you drown, right? Okay, so you have to be fairly well educated to know how to use that system, right, so that you get rid of CO2 so you don't feel like breathing underwater, but not so much to where you run out of oxygen before you come up to the surface and pass out. So those chemoreceptors are really important. What are some other things that can regulate ventilation. Higher centers in the brain, like the cerebral cortex, voluntary control, right? We said, well, we can hold our breath until we pass out if we really wanted to, right? Also, the hypothalamus, emotional content, emotional stimulus will adjust respiratory rate. Like if I tell you something really terrible, you just might actually gasp. You might go, and then your ventilation will increase. Proprioceptors, these are receptors in muscles and joints, and these joint receptors will measure whenever a joint is moving, right? And the muscle receptors, the spindle, when there is stretch of a muscle. So right now, even though you're not exercising, you could move your elbow, you could move your knees and your hips, and you're not really exercising. That will give you an urgency to inspire, even though you're not really exercising, but just by using joints and muscles, okay, very easily, right, then that will increase ventilation as well. And probably some athletes, before they undergo some kind of athletic event, right, they will use their muscles and joints just to get this respiratory system activated. Well, what are some other receptors? This is the last part of this chapter. Touch, right? So if somebody came over and touched you on the back of the neck and you didn't see them coming, what would happen to your respiratory rate or your ventilation? Or if somebody poked you in the side, it would increase, right? And you might even gasp, right? Pain can also increase respiratory rate, right? Maybe you grab something hot on the stove and you go, oh, and then you start hyperventilating as a result of that. Okay, any kind of pain, any kind of tissue damage. And temperature also, a sudden blast of cold air will produce a gasp reflex. So if I took an ice cube and put it someplace like on your neck or your back, that would stimulate this gasp reflex and you'd go, oh, that was really cold, right? And your ventilatory rate would increase. All right. A couple of years ago, there was a boat in Marina Del Rey Harbor that sunk. And it was this particular boat that's a party boat called Hornblower. And it was right around Christmas time. And some business was holding a party on this boat with about 50 or 60 people. And it was just going around the harbor. And all of a sudden, it caught on fire. And everybody had to get off the boat. And there were no life rafts on the boat. Okay, and so everybody in their tuxedos and fancy dresses had to jump into the harbor. And what's the temperature of water around here? Yeah, it's really cold. I would not like to jump into a harbor with a suit at night when it was dark, right? And so it was really kind of nasty circumstances. And I was reading the newspaper account, and I was just amazed that nobody drowned. Because as soon as you hit that water, that cold temperature is going to make you gasp. You go, oh, God, that's really cold water. But as you jump off of a boat into water, what happens to you and your head? You go kaplunk, and you have that gasp reflex. Chances are your head is going to be underwater when that happens. And so I was pretty amazed nobody drowned, and then I figured out probably what happened. Before they pushed everybody off the boat, they were given a life preserver. So the boat had to have life preservers for everybody. And so when they jumped in, they didn't really sink down into the water deep enough to where their head was underwater long enough to where they inhaled a bunch of ocean water. So that's kind of amazing. I hope none of you ever have to jump off a boat in the middle of the night, cold water, all dressed up without a wetsuit or anything like that. All right, so that's it for our respiratory chapter. Unless you have some questions. Any questions? Well, we're pretty good. All right, well, let's move on to digestive system. I'll put some of these slides away. Might as well put that away. Put that one away. That one. That one, that one. That one. Oh, probably even this one here. What's this? Put that away. Okay, digestive system. This is a system, when it works properly, is wonderful and amazing. But if it ever stops working and causes problems, it really changes somebody's life. right? You can really be miserable if the digestive system isn't working. So it's a system that we just take for granted. And tomorrow we're really going to take the digestive system for granted. And I want to show you something before we actually get into this chapter, because tomorrow is Thanksgiving. Let's take a look at this slide right here. All right, so what I'm looking at here are some internal organs of the abdominal and pelvic cavity. I do see the stomach. All right, so the stomach is pretty close to the diaphragm, so it's located way superior in the abdominal cavity. And here is the urinary bladder, which is really close to the floor of the pelvic cavity. So what's the distance between the stomach and the urinary bladder? Are they close together or are they far apart? Okay, one is up here, the other is way down here. What I want you to see is that they're far apart. Right? They're really far apart from each other. The stomach has a special property because it has a lot of folds called rugae. Maybe you saw those in, lab already. Maybe not. So let's find the stomach someplace. Okay, here's the stomach. So there's the stomach. Here are all of those folds that we call rugae. And when you eat something, the stomach can stretch out. And these folds right here just allow the stomach to stretch out without perforating. And people can eat so much that the stomach, where did that go? The stomach, okay. The stomach can stretch all the way down to the urinary bladder, which is pretty amazing. Where was that slide at? Is it here? Ah, here. Okay, so here's that stomach. We can eat so much that the stomach expands all the way down to the urinary bladder without perforating. You might not want to try that tomorrow, though. Probably is really uncomfortable when that happens. Bless you. Okay, so that's just kind of a special property of the stomach. And it holds that food until the small intestine is ready to process all of that material. All right, so here is the digestive system. It has some primary digestion and absorption organs, and then there are some accessory organs. And let's start with the oral cavity. Here's the oral cavity. That's usually how we eat. We got teeth, right, that crunches our food into smaller particles. Here's a tongue that mixes that stuff with saliva. Saliva has mucus, so it's kind of slippery, so it slips down through the pharynx into the esophagus. And here are some salivary glands that aid in swallowing. And the esophagus just takes that bolus of food from the oral cavity all the way down to the stomach, right through the thoracic cavity. All right, then we got food in the stomach. It gets processed, goes into the small intestine. Here is the small intestine. There are three divisions of the small intestine. The first one is duodenum, one in the middle is jejunum, and the last one is the ileum. And if I look at this slide right here, I could not tell you which is which, and probably nobody could, except I know that this segment that's closest to the stomach, I see it attached to the stomach, that has to be duodenum. Here is a segment that attaches to the large intestine. That has to be the ileum. But what's in the middle, the jejunum, I can't really tell where it begins and where it ends, right? That's just the way it is. So if somebody points to the middle right here, you would say jejunum. If somebody points up over here by the stomach, that would be duodenum. By the large intestine, that would be the ileum. All right. There are a couple other organs important for digestion. In lab, we're looking at the liver. The liver produces a compound called bile. Bile acts like a detergent or a soap so that oils can be emulsified and dissolve in water. Because, you know, oil and water don't mix. Bile is a compound that allows them to mix. The liver produces it all the time. When you're in a fasted state, that bile does not need to go to the small intestine, so it's stored in a place called the gallbladder, right underneath the liver. Okay, and then when you're in a fed state, that bile leaves the gallbladder, back into these ducts, ends up in the small intestine where it is necessarily used. All right, so here we have the components of the digestive system. What's another name for pharynx? Pharynx. It's a common name. When somebody has a pharyngitis, what do they have? Sore throat. That's right. When somebody loses their voice, what do they have? What do we call that when somebody loses their voice? That is a laryngitis, not pharyngitis. Right? So laryngitis is inflammation of the larynx. Right? Pharyngitis is inflammation of your throat, two different parts of your body. All right, so we're going to look at these different things throughout the lecture today and tomorrow if we have to go through there. All right, well, you all know that layers are important. You know layers of the heart, don't you? What are the layers of the heart, from superficial to deep? Okay, from superficial, what's right on the surface of the heart?
Epicardium.
Right, and then the muscle wall is the myocardium. And then the inner layers, the very thin, slippery, smooth one, that's the endocardium. Right, so you know the layers of the heart. Well, the digestive tract is a little bit more complicated. It has a couple different layers, more layers than that. All right, so let's take a look at some of these layers. And the important thing about layers is that when we understand the layers and how they're changing pathologically, we know a lot about the disease process, right? So it aids in diagnosis. And if you can come up with a diagnosis, that lends to coming up with an effective treatment, right? You can't figure out a treatment if you don't know what's wrong. And layers will help guide your decision. All right, so here are the layers. And we're going to start, okay, we're going to start with the innermost layer, which we call the mucosa. All right, so here is the mucosa, and I can see some layers. The epithelial layer, right here, epithelium, that is the layer that is facing the lumen of the tube. And it's a stratified squamous or maybe a simple columnar epithelium. Right, squamous when it's in your oral cavity and esophagus, but when it has to do a job like in the stomach and small intestine, then it turns into a columnar cell, and it's still simple. Then we have lamina propria that contains some glands and connective tissue, right? It's all part of the mucosa. And then we have the muscularis mucosa. There's some smooth muscle also. And what's the job of muscle in one word? Muscle is important for? Muscle is specialized for contraction, and that produces motility, right? Okay, so there is some smooth muscle in the mucosa. And then the next layer, okay, is what we call the submucosa. It's underneath. And so I see the submucosa right here, connective tissues, got some more glands, and it has nerves going through it, okay, but it doesn't have any muscle. And a lot of nerves move through it. Okay, then the next layer is the muscularis externa, and it has usually three layers. The stomach has three, but the intestine that we're looking at here has two. There is a circular smooth muscle that's deep, so when it contracts, it pinches off the tube, it pinches the tube, and then there are some longitudinal fibers. When it contracts, it makes the tube shorter in the direction that it contracts, right? So circular and smooth, that's the muscularis externa, longitudinal and circular muscles. Then on top of that, we have the serosa. And that's a kind of a thin layer, but it's really tough. And it's smooth and slippery so that these intestines can slip and slide around inside our abdominal cavity very easily. Right, so those are the layers. One interesting thing about these nerves. I see a bunch of nerves right here. We call that the myenteric nerve plexus. And that nerve plexus is all over, all these different layers right here, controlling all of these smooth muscles, right? Like the muscularis externa and the muscularis mucosae. And that controls how food is moving through your intestinal tract. And for years and years and years, when people looked at cadavers, they found all of these nerves in people's digestive tract, and they surmised that the digestive system was really the brain of people because there are so many nerves there. There are more nerves in your digestive tract than there are in your spinal cord. And hence I can see why it was pretty easy to mistake the digestive tract for a brain when it really isn't. Okay? Maybe it controls your brain sometime when you're really hungry, but it's really not your brain. It doesn't control other parts of your body. So this myenteric nerve plexus controls how things contract, okay? And there are two ways that your digestive system can contract. So let's see. Okay, here are the two ways. Here is a bolus of food that's being processed and nutrients are being absorbed. It can move in one direction, from your mouth down to your anus, just one direction. And we can see this pinch right here, and it will just move continuously down the way and just move this bolus of food in that one direction. And it's that myenteric nerve plexus that controls this contraction. Right? This kind of traction, right, from above to below movement, we call that peristalsis. That's moving digesting material in one direction, peristalsis. Right? There is another kind of motion. Let's take a look at that. So here we have a segment of your digestive tract, and it contains a certain material, and we kind of colored it a dark material. There are segments above and below, and we color them a lighter color. Right? And what segmentation does is that it pinches above and below the segment, and then all of a sudden this region relaxes and it pinches in the center of that compartment. Right? So now what do we have? We have this initial compartment, half in the one above, half in the one below. So it's mixing contents of these various segments together. Right? And then it goes back once again, and eventually there's a nice homogeneous mixture of food that's being digested instead of these discrete areas where there is a difference. Right? So this kind of process called segmentation, you should know as a mixing kind of function. Both of these are taking place in your intestines all the time. Mixing is an important function of the stomach, very important function of the stomach. Okay. So when food moves from your mouth to your anus, we call that anterograde propulsion. If it goes back, that's retrograde, just like for blood flow. If it goes in the direction it should, that's anterograde. Backwards is retrograde. And retrograde flow does not happen in the heart because why? Why is there no retrograde flow in the heart? Only anterograde. Because there's valves. How many valves in the heart? Four. Yeah. Okay. And we're going to see that there are some valves in your intestinal tract, but they're not like valves in the heart. They're valves made from smooth muscle, so they're active. They're not passive. Right? Then they'll control the movement of material. Okay, stomach. The important function of the stomach is storing and mixing. So whenever we eat something, it's stored in the stomach for a fairly long period of time until the small intestine is ready to receive that material and finish processing. All right, so what kind of motility is mixing? Segmentations, like this one over here. So that's the important thing about the stomach. And so what is it mixing together? Well, it's mixing together an enzyme called pepsin. Pepsin does an initial protein digestion, but it's incomplete. Right, so partial digestion of proteins, and it also secretes hydrochloric acid. Hydrochloric acid is necessary, right, so that pepsin has the proper activity. Right, and when there's hydrochloric acid, what is the acidity of the stomach? What's acidity if the stomach secretes hydrochloric acid into the lumen? High acidity. Now, what does that mean in terms of pH? You'll have to know that in physiology, probably not so much here. But as something becomes more acidic, the pH number decreases from 7. So the stomach has a pH number that's really, really small, like maybe 1, maybe sometimes 2. That's normal. Okay, so there are cells that secrete this enzyme and hydrochloric acid. There are other cells that secrete intrinsic factor. Intrinsic factor is necessary for your body to absorb vitamin B12. Vitamin B12 is necessary for growth, for mitosis. And one of the most mitotic tissues in your body are those that are making red blood cells. Remember, because you're losing about 2 million red blood cells every second, your body has to build 2 million red blood cells via mitosis. So vitamin B12 is necessary for that. If you're low on vitamin B12, what is something that shows up pretty soon that can be measured? Well, you can't make red blood cells. What is it called when you run really low on red blood cells? Anemia. That's right. So vitamin B12 deficiency shows up as anemia. And there are certain groups of people that have really poor diets with no vitamin B12 in them whatsoever. And they typically end up anemic. Okay. Can anybody think of a segment of society where they're malnourished, there's no vitamin B12 in their diet whatsoever?
Vegetarians,
yeah, maybe, but vitamin B12 you can get from vegetables. You can get from vegetables. But in particular, Okay, I'm thinking of a drug-seeking group, alcoholics. Right? If an alcoholic is drinking alcohol all day long and not food, they're vitamin B12 deficient, which means they are anemic as well. And when they show up into the emergency room, one of the things that they get is a vitamin B12 shot to help with that anemia. Okay. All right, so when the stomach is storing and mixing, it produces a mixture of food and gastric juice, which contains pepsin and hydrochloric acid and intrinsic factor. Then that mixture we call chyme. Right? Chyme originates in the stomach. All right, so let's take a look at the stomach, particular stomach. So we do have to know something about the anatomy of the stomach. I'm not so interested in anatomy of the tongue, but here's stomach. All right, so this is an exam figure. Here is the esophagus coming down from the oral cavity. And where it enters the stomach is what we call the cardiac region. And the muscle in this region is sort of strong, but it's not a nice strong circular muscle, so the stomach can never be cut off from the esophagus. Right? And under certain circumstances, when there's acid in the stomach, it can go back up into the esophagus and burn the esophagus. Right? That's called GERD. So when you have esophageal reflux that can damage the esophagus, cause ulceration. The reason why it doesn't happen most of the time is because when the esophagus comes down from the stomach, right, it comes straight down and then makes a bend, usually there's a kink that's placed right here. Right? So if you have a straw and bend it, it forms a kink so that fluid can't go through there. That's usually how material is controlled in this particular case. Right, so here is the cardiac region, probably because if you have reflux into the esophagus, you have a pain that feels like a heart attack, right? It's kind of in your chest, right? So this is the cardiac region. There is a region above the cardiac region that we call the fundus, the most superior part, right? Or the fundic region, fundic or fundus. And so you got to know this is above, the cardiac region is below, right by the esophagus, and for some reason, that's really hard for students to see. Maybe on a practicum, I'm going to put an arrow right here and ask, what part of the stomach is this? And half the class usually says cardiac region. But is this the cardiac region? It is not. It is the fundic region. It is the top region right here, which a bunch of gas accumulates in. Right? So you don't have chyme in this area. Usually you just have gas. All right, so fundic region. Then here's the body of the stomach. I can see those folds once again, which are what we call rugae. And the center of the stomach, the tube part of the stomach, of course, is called the lumen. And it kind of shrinks down to a funnel, right? At the distal end of the stomach, we call that the pyloric region. Pyloric region. So here's the body of the pylorus. Here's the pyloric canal bringing material toward the small intestine. And here is a really strong, powerful, smooth muscle. You'll be able to pinch this junction between the small intestine, which is the duodenum, and the stomach and lab, and you'll feel a knot right there, a really big knot. And you can even cut it open if you want to take a look at that pyloric sphincter. Sometimes it's called the pyloric valve. Right? And when it relaxes, contents of the stomach can move into the small intestine. When it's contracted, then contents can't move into the small intestine, and that usually means that the duodenum is busy processing food and cannot accept any more food from the stomach. Right? All right, so from the esophagus superiorly to the duodenum, we call this the lesser curvature. Then from the esophagus on this inferior margin over to the small intestine, that is the greater curvature. And notice that when we look at layers of that digestive tract, we saw two, but in the stomach, because one of its important jobs is segmentation, there are three layers of smooth muscle. Right? There's circular and longitudinal, just like in the rest of the digestive tract, but there's also this one that's angulated, which is an oblique layer. Okay, so inside the stomach, there are goblet cells. Goblet cells secrete mucus. Mucus is a really tough compound, and even strong acid can't destroy mucus. So when there's a nice, efficient mucus lining of the stomach, then the hydrochloric acid that's secreted into the lumen can't digest the stomach down just because of that mucus. Right? That's the reason why it's there. The parietal cells secrete hydrochloric acid and intrinsic factor. And a different kind of cell, these chief cells secrete pepsinogen and gastric lipase. All right, so does anybody know what a lipase will digest? Okay, because whenever you see a term with an ASE on the end of it, that's a clue that it is an enzyme. And a lot of times, at least in modern nomenclature, we use the substrate or whatever the compound is that's going to be digested, right, as part of the name. So lipid is a compound. Sugars are compounds. Proteins are compounds. So a lipase is an enzyme, because of ASE, that will break down lipids, will help digest lipids. And it comes from the stomach, so hence gastric lipase. Pepsinogen is also an interesting word, because it doesn't have an ACE at the end of it. It has an O-gen. That also tells you something. If you have a word with O-gen on the end of it, it means that it is inactive. It is not an active enzyme, but it can be converted into one pretty quickly. And so that's the beauty of pepsinogen. It's produced in the stomach, but it's only activated when hydrochloric acid from parietal cells is also secreted into the stomach. Okay, pepsinogen. You'll learn a lot of words, like angiotensinogen. What's the activity of angiotensinogen, even if you haven't heard of angiotensin before? Angiotensinogen is inactive because of O-gen at the end of the word, but it can be converted into an active form very quickly. There are also endocrine cells in the stomach, and they secrete gastrin, right? And so what does an endocrine gland, what's the product called? Here it's called, the specific name is gastrin. So what is gastrin? If it's secreted by an endocrine cell, it is a hormone, right? So it's a hormone that travels through the blood and goes to various places. It goes back to the stomach, right? And it tells the parietal cells to secrete hydrochloric acid when food enters the stomach. Kind of interesting that the stomach regulates itself. All right, and so all of these secretions by the stomach equals about a liter and a half. Gastric juice is about a liter and a half every single day. And so what's a liter? Anybody have a water bottle? How much is that? That's maybe like a quarter of a liter. Go ahead, hold that up. That's probably about a quarter of a liter. So 4, 5, 6 of those containers are secreted into the stomach every day, which is a lot of fluid. And you have to be concerned whenever your body loses fluid. Fluid from your body entering the digestive tract is lost fluid. It's not inside your body. All right, maybe I forgot to mention something. Did I mention salivary glands here? No. Salivary glands. Salivary glands secrete about the same, about a liter of fluid into your mouth every day. So if you were to walk around and spit into a container, you'd measure about a liter. All right, so far, going from your oral cavity through the stomach, you've lost 2.5 liters of fluid. So we're just going to keep tabs of that. All right, so then chyme enters the small intestine through this pyloric sphincter here, and now the function of the small intestine is digestion and absorption of nutrients, right? Not so for the stomach, right? What's the function of the stomach? Function of stomach? Go ahead, tell me, what's the function of the stomach? Storing and mixing, that's right. Not digestion and absorption like you would think for the digestive tract. Right, that is the job of the small intestine. So here is the small intestine. Here's the small intestine. I want to get to that in just a little bit. Small intestine, what's a really good way of looking at small intestine? I can't really show you the whole extent of the small intestine. Here is small intestine, and it's all coiled up. It's a very long tube because it takes a long time to digest and absorb nutrients from the small intestine. And there has to be a doorway for absorption, right? And did we ever think about surface area? Did we talk about surface area ever for like the respiratory tract? And what does surface area mean? Okay, we didn't. All right, so here's a ruler. I want to measure something. Okay, surface area is measured by measuring the width of something, like this table, Okay, and then the length of something, of this table, we multiply those two numbers together, and that tells us the surface area of this particular table. And it would be measured in meters, because I have a meter stick right here. All right, we could measure the surface area of something else, like maybe this doorway over here. Let's measure the surface area of the doorway. So, how wide is this doorway? Wow, look at that. It's exactly 1 meter. That's nice. And then we need to multiply that number by what? Its height, right, to find the surface area. So we got 1 meter, okay, and then I got to move the ruler a little bit, put it exactly right where I left off so that we're nice and precise, and oh look, it's exactly 2 meters. So that's good. So what's the surface area of this door? 1 times 2, which is 2 square meters. How many people can get through this doorway at one time? Maybe three? Three people, right? So what happens if we increase the surface area of this door, make it twice the size? How many people can get through the doorway? More, the same, or less? More, a lot more. So as the surface area increases, right, then more things can move across it. So surface area is a concept for exchange, like absorption in the small intestine. So in order to absorb nutrients, would you like to have a large surface area or a small surface area? Small doorway, large doorway for absorption. Okay, it is a large area. You want a large doorway so that material can move from the lumen of the intestine into your body, the largest area that's possible. So how does the stomach, or how does the small intestine increase surface area for absorption? That's what we're going to look at now. I had it just a second ago. Right here. Okay, so here's an illustration of the small intestine. And the function of the small intestine is digestion and absorption. And in order for absorption to take place, we need a large surface area, a large doorway. So whenever I say surface area, what's the everyday item that you should think about when I say surface area? We measured it over here. Surface area and doorway are the same. All right, so how do we increase the surface area of this, or how did evolution increase the surface area for the small intestine? All right, so here is some small intestine, and you can see all of these folds. Right, so the intestine has a certain length, but it would be a lot longer if we were to pull either end of the small intestine so that all of these folds would lie flat. Do you see that? The length would be a lot longer, and that's just one way to think of increasing surface area. Well, these folds right here are called plicae circularis, or circular folds, because they encircle the small intestine. But I see some other kinds of folds. On top of a circular fold, then I see these projections right here coming up. Kind of look like little fingers. These are almost visible underneath with the naked eye. Okay, the inside of the stomach doesn't look flat and smooth. It kind of looks velvety because of all of these structures that we call villi. Right, and if we wanted to measure the true surface area of the small intestine, not only would we have to pull it from end to end to get rid of these circular folds, we'd have to keep pulling it to get rid of all of these villi so that they lie nice and flat and straight. Okay, so that's the second thing, circular folds, villus. And then there's a third thing that increases the surface area, and that is all of the cells. Okay, let's zoom in right here. So here is a section of the small intestine. Here is a villus, and here are the columnar cells. If we look at the surface of these columnar cells, we see that there are even more folds, and these are what we call microvilli. And I think when we went and looked at cell organelles, we said that microvilli increase surface area of a cell because the cell functionally is not wide from here to here. It's a lot wider, right? Because in order to find out really how wide the cell is, we'd have to pull it from right to left to get all of these microvilli flat, straightened out. All right, so the cell is a lot wider than it looks right here. But all of these folds just allow the cell to be put in a small space. Right? And all of these villi right here just allow a really, really long tube to be crinkled up into a small space. And the same thing for the circular folds. Right? It just kind of shortens the length of the small intestine without decreasing the surface area. So there are three things that increase surface area for absorption: the microvilli of the villus and the circular folds increase the length of the small intestine so that it has time to do its job. Okay, this slide is also interesting because I see some goblet cells in the epithelium, I see an artery, and I see a vein. So there's capillaries right here for absorption of nutrients. So amino acids and sugars get absorbed by the cardiovascular system. They get absorbed by these capillaries. But here is another kind of vessel. This is not a blood vessel. This is a lymphatic vessel. And this lymphatic vessel that's running right through the center of a villus is important for absorption of fat and lipid. And that lymphatic vessel is a lymphatic capillary. That's what we call a lacteal. Talked about it in the last chapter, but I didn't have this slide in that last chapter. Right, and it runs right up the middle of this villus for fat absorption. Right, the small intestine also secretes into the lumen. There are intestinal glands that secrete intestinal juice. Remember that the stomach is very acidic. When that material gets put into the small intestine, then it's neutralized with bases that are secreted from both the pancreas and the small intestine. So an additional almost 2 liters of fluid gets secreted into the digestive tract just in the small intestine. So how many liters of fluid have we lost now through the oral cavity, stomach, and small intestine? Say one from the oral cavity, was it 1.5 from the stomach, almost 2, so 4.5 liters of fluid you lose, right, just by the normal function of the digestive tract. That's a lot of fluid. It's very easy to dehydrate under those circumstances. All right, so again, we're just going to keep that in the back of the mind, and we'll talk about that in a little bit. All right, so if we go back to think about surface area, if we measure the surface area of the small intestine without consideration of any of those folds, right, if we just measure the length of this tube without unfolding any of the circular folds or the villi or anything, right, and measure how flat it is, the surface area, it would be about 3.5 square feet. The surface area is really, really small. But because of all of these folds, the plicae circularis, the villi, and microvilli, if we were to flatten all of those out, then the surface area would expand to about 240 square meters, or 2,200 square feet. About 3 to begin with, over 2,000 once we flatten out all of these folds right here. And that surface area is equal to the average two-level house, the floor area of an average two-level house. That's a huge doorway, right? And so what's that doorway important for? Absorption of nutrients, right? That happens in the small intestine. Okay, so that's the job of the small intestine. There are capillaries that absorb amino acids and sugars. There are lacteals that absorb fats. All right, here are some things that the small intestine has a number of different kinds of glands, like Brunner's glands, and they secrete that alkaline-like material to neutralize stomach acid. There are also Brunner glands in the large intestine for doing the same kind of thing. And they have also little nodes called pyre patches, which contain malt. Remember when we talked about malt, it's part of your immune system. It can be activated by bacteria, and then your body can come up with an immune response to deal with those bacteria, like making B lymphocytes. All right, so that's the small intestine. Pancreas. The pancreas lies underneath the stomach, and I see it right here. Here's the pancreas, here's the tail, here's the head, the wide region. And the pancreas is pretty interesting because it has both endocrine function and exocrine function. So if it's an endocrine function, it means that it's secreting a hormone, and that goes into the blood, travels everywhere in the body. And one hormone that you're familiar with that comes from the pancreas is insulin. right, that decreases blood glucose. There's also another hormone called glucagon that increases blood glucose, but they both come from the pancreas. That's the endocrine function. We're not so concerned with that in the digestive system chapter. What we're interested in is the exocrine function of the pancreas. The exocrine means that the pancreas produces a compound and secretes it into a duct, and the duct in particular I see right here is the pancreatic duct. And where does it take that material? Right to the small intestine. Right, so here is another sphincter called the hepatopancreatic sphincter that controls the fluid flow from, right, from the liver and the pancreas into the small intestine. And bile, right, has to go through this area as well as secretions from the pancreas. And the secretions from the pancreas are alkaline to neutralize stomach acid, but they also include enzymes for digesting material, like trypsin and chymotrypsin for protein digestion. The initial part of protein digestion happened in the stomach with pepsin, but then it's finished off in the small intestine with trypsin and chymotrypsin, and then also secretes amylase, right? Amylose is a sugar. Amylase is the enzyme that breaks sugar down. So that's for sugar digestion. And we said pancreatic lipase for lipid digestion. That's how that works. Okay, we talked about the head and tail. And next time, we're going to finish up by talking about the large intestine. But I want you to memorize the function of the stomach, the function of the small intestine, so we can contrast it and compare it with the function of the large intestine next time.